Hello and welcome to All Things Botanical. I'm your host, Michaela Morgan, and today we'll be doing our first industry deep dive, where we talk to people who have made a career from working with plants. On today's episode, we will be deep diving into the wonderful world of horticulture, and we will be talking to one of my favorite people in the world, and arguably the person who kickstarted my interest in the plant world, and that's you, Dad.
Howdy.
So this is Mark Morgan. He has been a horticulturalist and business owner for over 30 years. So welcome, Dad. Thanks for joining.
Oh, pleasure.
I would say whether it was intentional or not, you've been pretty influential in me developing an interest in the plant world. And I've always sort of looked up to you and thought you were pretty lucky that you got to spend your whole time working outside with some plants. So can you tell us how you got into horticulture and what made you decide to go down that path?
When I left my teaching job, I started up a lawn mowing business because I used to look after one of my friend's lawn mowing business when he went on holidays. And after I'd done it a couple of times, I thought, God, this guy's making a lot more money than I am. And so I came back to Wollongong and I started my own lawn mowing business. As it sort of progressed through the seasons, well, people started asking me, you know, technical questions like, what's that plant? And, you know, what coloured flowers does it get? And I was just guessing, you know, they'd say, what's the best time of the year to prune this thing? Now, of course, get money for it. But over a...
Your little schemer.
Yeah. Over a period of 12 months or so, I thought, I'm going to get caught out here. Like, somebody asked me what colour flowers this thing has and I say blue and it turns out to be yellow, then they'll know that I'm a bit of a charlatan. So I actually went and made some inquiries about... and what sort of course I could do to learn a bit more about the plants, not so much the lawn, but the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the course that everybody was doing was called the Horticulture Certificate Course.
Okay.
And that was a really involved course because what's happened since I did my course is they've broken our original course up into all different like separate courses now.
Yeah.
But when we did it, it was all encompassed in one. So it was, you know, the horticulture certificate covered garden design, construction, parks and gardens, arboriculture, pest and disease management. There was a whole raft of different subjects and they split it all up now. So the people are doing now, they've got it really easy. They can just specialise in one. But we had to do everything.
So did you do all of that in order to become a horticulturalist or did you cover – okay, so you didn't go off on like a certain pathway.
No, there were no options. It was everything or nothing.
And was it like a TAFE course? Because it sounds like pretty intense. Yeah, TAFE course. Yeah, wow. So it's, would you say it would be sort of like an equivalent to what you would do at uni now?
Yeah, well, I went to uni to do my teaching stuff and I worked twice as hard doing the horticulture certificate as what I did doing the teaching stuff. But the teaching was easy compared to this course because there was so much involved. It was quite scientific as well.
Okay, so this is one of the questions I really wanted to ask you because I've been known to send you random text with just an image of a plant and I just ask you, oh, what is this? And you come back to me every time with an answer. So are you doing the old dodgy like you were with the mowing lawns and just telling me whatever they are?
Yes.
No, but it's actually, I find it so interesting and sometimes I'll just do it for fun to sort of impress my friends. Like we'll be walking around and I'll be like, oh, they're like, oh, what's this plant? Like, it looks really cool. And I'm like, don't worry, my dad knows literally every plant, and I'll send a picture and you'll come back and tell us what it is. So how did you memorize all of the plants? Like, there was no internet or anything just to Google it. So it sounds pretty full on.
When we did the course, every week that we went in, we'd have a set number of plants that we'd do a profile on.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm talking about, like, there were thousands of them, absolutely thousands of them, and we had to record all the information about that plant, mm-hmm. just like you'd find in a botanical description in a book.
Yeah.
You know, the leaf margin, the tip, how the venation, you know, the veins are situated on the leaf, the colour, shape. There's so much information that you had to know about every plant. Not only that, you know, the time of the year that it flowers, pests and diseases that are common to that particular plant. And we had a profile sheet for every plant. Mm-hmm. And then each term, once the term had finished, we had to go and do a plant identification test based on all these plants that you'd covered. So when they introduce a plant at TAFE, they'd bring a sample in and they'd show it to you. And then they bring a branch in.
Yeah. Know?
But that didn't show you what the form of the plant was. It was just a branch. So you had to, you know, look at that and then go out in the streets, in the gardens, in the suburbs, and then try and find an example of that plant so you could see what it actually looked like and what its form was. And
that's so cool. So, yeah. You had a textbook that had, like, just...
No, not a textbook. We had just profile sheets that we wrote up ourselves, and we wrote all the information that the lecturers gave us.
Right.
Based on our observations in class as well. Wow. So if you weren't satisfied with some of the information that the lecturer had given you and you wanted to write more in, you just wrote, you know, extra stuff on your profile sheet. And then you kept your profile sheets in a folder each year. So the course ran for 3 years, and each year you'd have a whole folder just jam-packed full of profile sheets. And not only that, we had to do take cuttings and press them. So we had a collection of pressed flowers as well,
and
pressed leaves, so you could bring up and, you know, like either one of them, cross-reference between them.
And so were they only Australian native plants, or like did they go out into the wild?
Exotics. They did exotics as well. Like there was a separate section completely on eucalyptus species, for example.
Yeah, cool.
There's just hundreds of them.
Yeah.
But we stuck mainly with the ones in our local area, the ones that you'd find around, you know, Illawarra.
So did they have, like, if they were exotics, did the lecturer just get them sent in from wherever?
Like an exotic is a plant that originates from another country or another region.
Yeah.
So say Japanese maple, for example. Yeah. Obviously it comes from Japan.
Yeah.
But there's plenty of them growing over here, so they just grab a sample.
Okay.
From a nursery, or from, like, the TAFE colleges kept their own nurseries then.
Right.
And they had all the plants that you needed that were in your course. So they had plenty of them on hand.
So that's a pretty hands-on course. Like now, like, so for example, when I've been looking and considering what, you know, pathway to study, not only because of COVID, but just the way that we are these days, everything seems to be online. And this is the part I don't really understand. How are you supposed to retain the information and understand the plant and the makeup of the plant digitally? Like, I don't know how. Yeah, you can't.
You might get some of it, but you won't get all of it. Like we had to, if we were given a list of plants that we had to identify, then we had to go out into the streets and walk around and look in people's gardens and sometimes snip a cutting off and go and knock on the door, and you know, they wouldn't let you do it, you'd snip it off on the way out anyway.
Dad.
That way, at least it's there right in front of you.
Yeah.
And you can identify all those different features yourself rather than just what's written in a textbook.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I mean, I don't know whether you know or not, but I've secretly accumulated a fair few of your books over the years. Many.
I have noticed that there are a lot of gaps in my bookshelves now.
A lot of them decided to join me on my move down to Melbourne. And I was looking it through some of them earlier today, and like people have hand-drawn a lot of the illustrations and that kind of thing. So did you get marked or, you know, judged on being able to draw? Because I remember when you were doing your sort of more of your landscaping business from home, before we had like the internet and stuff, you had like a drawing board and you had to draw all of your plans to scale and make sure that they all would work properly, you know, in somebody's garden. So how do you think things have changed since you first started out? Like, do you think it's better or worse?
It's definitely easier to do a plan if you're using CAD, computer aided design.
Yeah.
But like when we were doing it, you could really personalize the plan, and the way that you present it to a client may determine whether or not you get the job. So if you spend all this time doing all this detail and you show the plants in colour and you draw them to scale so that people can see what those plants are going to look like in, you know, 10 years' time rather than what they are when you just put them in the ground. If you put them on the ground, they just look like specks. But if you draw them to scale so that it shows the full extent of their crown when they, you know, 10 years old, you know that you've got it in the right place and it's not going to crowd out, you know, half a dozen other plants as well.
Yeah, and right.
So I found the design side of it like really interesting, and that's what won me most of my work, because I was really particular about the presentation of the plants.
Yeah, no, it's funny you mentioned that. Like, so I find it really interesting to watch you when you're sort of dealing with the plants, because you seem to kind of go into a bit of a flow state, like what you would describe like an artist does. Like, I find you are very meticulous and you have this sort of, it's very delicate the way that you deal with the plants. So you're very slow, you're very calculated, very careful, like you treat them with like a lot of respect. Have you ever thought about that?
Well, they're a living thing.
Yeah.
You're not the only living thing on the planet. And I remember when I first started my business off, I was trying to think of some sort of a catchphrase that I could use that people would latch on to and identify that, you know, identify with me as a person that's got their best interests at heart.
Yeah.
And so I on my logo around the outside, I put a little ring, and then I put helping Mother Earth give birth, and heaps of people, you know, picked on that, you know, seized on that, and said, "Oh, I love that! I love your logo."
Oh, that's so cute, Dad. Yeah. That's really cute. I love that. I feel like this. Yeah, this is really why I wanted to talk to you first, I guess, about when I talk to people who have made a career out of plants, because, yeah, you, like, you know, are quite a masculine dude, you know, like you're a tradie, like you're heaps into sport, like not none of this matters, but I find...
I'm very good looking too.
Yeah. Is that mum?
Yeah, that was a trick.
But I find I really connect to a side of you that's quite empathetic and compassionate and caring. I think it's really cute how you connect with the plants and how you, I love that you treat them like they are a living being and that you you won't do anything unless it's done properly and like you, it's got long-term sustainability and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
You've got to give them the best chance that you possibly can for them to, you know, grow into the plant they were meant to be, rather than just stick them in the ground and hope that they're going to look after themselves. There's a lot of nurturing involved if you want them to produce the goods for you.
And, for sure.
That takes time and care.
Aw, that's so cute, Dad. So let's talk growing plants. Much to Mum's dismay, you've got a pretty good propagation station happening on the back deck at the moment. And you started those off just from the seeds of the fruit that you bought from the supermarket, hey?
Yeah. Some plants, you know, you can reproduce them from seed.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them, particularly some of the stone fruits, they won't actually grow true to type. So
what does that mean?
Well, if you're eating a pink lady apple, for example.
Yeah.
And you get the seeds out of that apple and you put them in a container and you try and propagate, and you might be able to strike a few seedlings and then suddenly you'll have new plants growing. But there's no guarantee that new seedling that's just grown is going to be a pink lady apple.
Oh, wow.
Because a lot of them are grafted and a lot of them will actually go back to the original fruit, say, you know, the grafted.
So what does grafting mean? Like, are they blended with a different species?
It's like in grafting, you've got a what they call an understock and a scion. So the understock obviously is the part that goes in the ground and the scion is the part above the graft, like when you join them.
Okay.
So what happens if you've got an old, really hardy stock, like a rootstock for apples, because mm-hmm. there's some plants that they grow them just for the rootstock because they produce all these rootstock plants and they chop the top off them. Then they graft the desired variety on top of that. There's an old bush lemon, I think it's called Poncyrus or something like that. I can't remember exactly. But they grow it specifically for the rootstock. And then once they strike it, they cut the top off and then they graft, which means to join the desired variety
mm-hmm.
on top of that rootstock. And the rootstock is used because it's much more resistant to pests and disease and all that sort of thing.
Right.
Whereas if you just, you know, grow an orange from a seed and you stick it in the ground, it's not as resistant to pests and diseases as this old rootstock, the old bush lemon.
Okay.
The old bush lemons are horrible looking things and they've got spikes and things all over them.
Yeah, they've evolved.
Yeah, but you have a look at every orange or mandarin or lemon or lime plant that you'll buy in a nursery, and if you look down the bottom, you'll see a thicker section coming up out of the pot and then there's a definite regrowth out to the side, and that's where it was grafted with the variety of citrus that you were you're after.
That's wild. So this is probably a deep question, but have you noticed changes in the quality or the durability of plants over the time that you'd buy for clients?
Yeah, I find like with a lot of the fruit varieties, like there's so much involved in producing a fruit that's aesthetically pleasing rather than nourishing or tasty.
Yeah.
You buy a peach in a supermarket and the bloody thing looks beautiful.
Mm.
When you cut the thing open and you bite it, it might be on a toilet paper roll.
I know. It's actually like interesting how society's need for you know, perfection and like cosmetic perfection has translated into our buying habits with food. It's, yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The other side of the coin too is there's so much wastage because if you look at the big supermarkets, you know, a grower will supply them with, say, bananas. There was a big stink about bananas last year. Because the supermarkets will only take the bananas that are perfectly yellow with no black marks on them and no odd shape or anything. Whereas, you know, fruit that's organically grown is never going to be perfect in shape or form, but it's certainly going to taste a whole lot better than the perfectly symmetrical bananas that you buy in a supermarket. And then the supermarkets reject all this, like, this enormous amount of fruit that just gets bulldozed back into the ground again because the growers can't do anything. They've already picked it, given it to the supermarket. The supermarket doesn't want it. What are they going to do? They can't sell it themselves. So it's just completely wasted, like tons and tons.
It's disgusting.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with it except that it's not up to the aesthetic standards of the, you know, the big supermarket chains.
Yeah, it's disgusting. It makes you sick, doesn't it? I mean, so on that point, we'll go back to your propagation station. And if people are wanting to, you know, it's so easy to just go down to the shops and grab your food. You don't have to do anything. Like, everything's so convenient. But if people are wanting to sort of reconnect back with nature and grow their own fruits and veggies at home, how did you set up your propagation station and how did you know what to do with each of the different seeds? Like, are there different care for different plants? And how long does it sort of take to grow from seedling and then repotting into larger garden beds and all of that?
Well, it all comes down to what you learn in your course, and what you pick up from other people that are experienced as well. Like, you can't just, if you want to grow blueberries, for example, you can't just grow blueberries from seed because the chances of them actually working is pretty well zero. So what you've got to do with a lot of those plants is you've actually got to put them in the fridge and simulate an overwintering period. So for a lot of the stone fruits, for example, they won't shoot from seed unless there's been a period that equates to a normal winter. So so those seeds will only, you know, regenerate when they've had a period of, you know, temperature below a certain level. And so by putting them in the fridge for a couple of months, you're simulating, you know, the overwintering is what they call it. And then when you put the plant, put the seed back out into a little mini glass house, at its overwintering period, it's ready to germinate. And it usually happens fairly quickly after you put it into the seeding mix.
So how do you make a mini glass house? Is it just, I've seen you do it with plastic bottles, yeah?
Yeah, you can do it. Anyone can do it. I used to use old coat hangers and plastic bags when I first started doing it. And that's how I propagated my mango seedlings. But now you can put one seed in one pot, just cut the top of an old Coke bottle off, turn it upside down, and straight away you've got the bottom of the bottle goes over the pot.
Yeah.
Then you've created your own little mini glass house.
And so do you just sit it in direct sunlight?
Yeah. Well, sometimes if it's direct sunlight and there's, you know, moisture that condenses inside that bottle, then those droplets of moisture can act as magnifying glasses and you can actually burn the seedlings.
Oh, my gosh.
So when they first, you know, start to shoot, you're better off to have them in a partly shaded or lightly shaded sort of area that still gets warmth but doesn't get direct sunlight.
Yeah.
And then as they start to grow and they start to harden off, you move them from one level of light, sunlight, to the next level of sunlight. You leave them there for a little while, so they acclimatise to that, and then eventually you can get them out into full sun. You can't just go from a seedling in the shade and stick it out in the sun, because it'll just keel over. They've got to acclimatise.
Okay. And so what do you think is the easiest thing for people to get started with, just so they don't get disheartened if they plant the seeds and nothing happens, which I've definitely been there.
probably best just to play around with some seed stock, you know, like if you've just eaten a mango, for example, you can hang the mango seed out in the sun for a couple of days and let it dry out. And then you can actually separate the husk along one seam on the side of the seed, and take the embryo out and stick that into a sandy seedling mix just below the surface. Keep the moisture up to it. Put an empty Coke bottle over the top of the pot so that you create your own little glasshouse. And out of that one mango seed, you might get four or five new seedlings. When they get to a reasonable size, you can actually separate the seedlings, put them in separate pots, and you've got, you know, five or six new mango trees.
So what is the easiest kind of plant to grow from home? Is it fruit or veggies or herbs?
You can buy vegetable seedlings, you know, like tomato and, you know, carrot, like all that sort of stuff. You can get all those stuff commercially available in places like Bunnings. You just go and buy a packet of them, and, you know, watermelons, whatever, and you can just throw the seeds. They're ready for planting. You just throw the seeds into a seedling mix, keep the moisture up to them, and if you've done half a reasonable job, you'll get some decent results. It's pretty easy.
And so do you have to put the seedlings in like a smaller little garden bed before you move them into the ground? Yeah,
you can get seedling trays,
yeah,
that are actually divided up. It's like a whole series of tube stock size little planters all merged into one big seedling tray. So you might have, you know, 30 to 40 seedlings that you can put into each of these little compartments. Some of them come in a kit form where you can get a plastic, like mini glasshouse container, and you put the seedling trays in that container.
Yeah,
so
nice.
So after you plant them out, you put them in the container and you've got an instant glasshouse. Tends to accelerate because it keeps the heat in, keeps the wind out, keeps the moisture in, and they tend to germinate a lot quicker.
Okay, and so once they've germinated and they've sprouted out of the soil, how big do they have to grow before you need to move them?
You leave them in there until they, you know, depending on what particular plant it is, you want the root system to develop enough so that when you take it out of that little compartment, they don't just, all the soil and the roots don't just fall away because they're unsupported. So you leave them in there until the roots actually fill the little compartment reasonably well. And you might leave them in there for a month, say.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on the variety, you could have, you know, up to 100 mil or 150 mil in height of whatever that particular plant is. And you sort of know through experience eventually when the plant's reached the point where it's ready to come out and be repotted. Because if you leave it in there too long, the roots sort of grow into and around each other, and the thing becomes pot bound. And you don't want to stick it into a new, bigger pot if the root system is all over the place.
Yeah, okay. And what about flowers? So can you just plant them straight into a garden bed, or do you need to
Same thing, you can get seedling mixes for flowers.
Yeah.
So you can just go and buy, again, in Bunnings or any retail nursery. You can just buy packets of seeds, just throw them. A lot of people who like annuals, you know, seed plants that only flower or once a year kind of thing. People go and buy those ones because it's instant colour. Mm. It's an instant effect, you know. Throw the seedlings into the tray, up they come, take them out, plant them off into the garden, and you've got an instant, you know, colour.
So annuals, does that mean that they bloom all year round, and then is perennial seasonal?
A perennial is a plant that will grow and produce seed and flower, you know, for a couple of years at least, as compared to an annual, which will just grow, produce seed and flower once and then die. Perennials usually they'll last longer than an annual, a lot hardier.
Yeah.
And they'll flower multiple times, you know, throughout the year, a perennial.
So, like, is lavender a perennial?
Yeah.
Yeah. And then an annual would be like a rose.
No, because a rose will keep growing. An annual will die. So like petunias.
Okay.
That's a pretty good example of an annual.
Okay.
People put them in for instant colour and they grow, they flower, and then they die.
Right. Okay. That makes total sense.
Like some of my books have got all that information in them. I don't know whether they're the ones that you've stolen or not.
I stole the, I think it's called the Guide to Australian Wildflowers. And they're right. All like little illustrations of all the different flowers and then the botanical name, where they're found and all that kind of stuff. So that one's been really interesting. But it is a little bit overwhelming. There's so many.
Oh, there's so much. There's so much. That's why people, you know, tend to specialise in one field rather than try and be an expert in multiple fields, because you can't be an expert in everything. You can't know everything there is to know about everything. So people tend to pick and choose the areas of interest, and then they tend to put all their effort into those areas. So they become a specialist in those areas rather than have a general knowledge of everything.
Yeah, right. What is your favourite type of work? Like, do you prefer to do the landscape design and like drawing, or if you went back, would you specialise in a particular type of plant species?
Well, most of my work now is landscape construction. And a lot of people tend to be confused because they think that a landscaper is just a gardener.
Mm.
There's a distinct difference. Like, a gardener is a person who just looks after lawns and gardens, like plants, you know.
Like maintenance.
Yeah, it's just maintenance. That's what a gardener does, looks after lawns and maintenance of garden beds and plants, whereas a landscaper is responsible for designing and constructing the overall landscape, not just the part that the plants are in, because there's more to it than just the plants. So it might be, you know, showing how you're going to retain a bank, or what sort of hard surfaces like paving and decking that you're going to use, and how that's going to relate to other elements in the environment. Whereas as a garden, it's just the lawn and the plants.
Right.
And so a gardener and a landscaper are two completely different things. And a horticulturist isn't a gardener either, because a horticulturist actually uses scientific information to aid in the production and cultivation of plants.
Right.
And that may take into account, you know, studies of the soil, studies of the plant varieties, studies of pests and diseases that are common to those type of plants, unique climatic conditions, unique environmental conditions. You know, it's such a technical field, and, you know, people just don't understand what the difference is between those three sort of occupations. They're completely separate from one another.
For sure. And this is, I guess, kind of why I decided to make this podcast, because I wanted to understand more the differences between the career pathways and the options available to me. So, Dad, why horticulture over the other elements?
Horticulture is really important because of, like, the technical aspect of it. Like, major companies use horticulturists to solve problems of land degradation, for example, after they've, you know, dug a great hole in the ground for an open-cut mine or something or other, and they've got to restore it. It's the horticulturists are the ones that actually advise on the best way to do that and the best approach. It's the same with, you know, whether it's on a large scale like that or whether it's just in a backyard application, it's that technical knowledge that the horticulturist supplies that allows these developments to progress the way they do.
It sounds like horticulture, you know, is definitely not a crash course. Like, you can't just go and do, you know, your certificate online and be ready to go out and start taking clients and know what you're doing. Like,
no, you'll end up being like Mark the Lawnmower back in, you know, 1980, just guessing and telling people all sorts of misinformation just so you could make some money.
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot of Mark the Lawnmowers out there at the moment. What's your favourite type of work to do?
Oh, definitely propagation. It's because it's so rewarding, you know. It's like you're producing babies, whether you're doing it through cuttings or through, you know, seed propagation. It's just so interesting, like all the different techniques you can use, and it's such a buzz when you do it. And you walk out one day and you see a couple of new shoots on a graft that you've done, and you think, oh, God, I've done it. It's working.
I feel like we have to do I might get you back on to do a whole episode just on propagation, because I feel like you could really give us some stellar info on that. It would take a little bit longer to go through.
Yeah. It's not only rewarding because you've actually produced another living thing, but, you know, it's, say, if you're growing stuff from seedling, it's a bit of a lucky dip, you know, and that's how all these new varieties of fruits appear, because you grow stuff by seed, and instead of it reverting back to the, you know, like, so we use pink lady apples as an example again. You get the seeds from a pink lady, you propagate them, and you get, you know, five or six new seedlings shoot up. They grow into a fruit-bearing apple tree, but they may not be a pink lady apple. They may be some other form of apple that no one's even heard of yet. Cool. Right? And that's how varieties appear. That's why we get all these different varieties of different fruits, because somebody has, you know, in their propagation process, has developed a different strain of the same plant, and with its own unique features, and there's a new species.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
So what is your favourite plant, if you had to choose one?
Autumn foliage plants, for sure. I love the colours that the autumn – I love the form of the plants as well, like the trees. There's this big, beautiful, grand-looking specimens, and, you know, and the different colours that you – it's almost like they're lit from – like they're a lamp and they've been lit from the inside. You know, when they colour up, you get all the reds and the yellows and purples. Oh, it just looks beautiful.
What would be, like, the names of some of those? Are they more trees that you like?
Yeah, most of them. Most of them are trees. There's a lot of, like, the flowering cherries and the Japanese maples, a lot of the asters and the elms, and, like, they're just beautiful, beautiful trees. When you see them in mature form, and they're losing their leaves, and all the coloured leaves are all over the ground. Ah, I love it.
Oh, you'll have to come, I think, up in the Macedon Ranges. I think there's a lot of those types of trees.
In Bright?
Oh, yeah, like down the southern side.
Like them, their street trees are all autumn foliage trees. You go through Bright in or Orange in, you know, central New South Wales. Orange is another example where the most of the trees are autumn foliage trees, and it's just sensational to see the colour, see them colour up. You know, and the beauty of those is that you know, you've got beautiful shade in summer, then they colour up in autumn, then they lose their leaves in winter, and you get the warmth of the sun coming through where the trees used to be. So, you know, you get the best of both worlds. You get shade in summer and warmth in winter.
Oh, that's so good. I never even think about those sorts of things, you know, like how to stay warm, or like, I just think, yeah, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I just don't think about how you can use plants to keep cool or to stay warm, anything like that.
Yeah, no, it's just things that you learn.
How do you think people's connection with the plants around them has changed since you've been in the industry?
I think people are becoming a lot more aware of the importance of plants now. You know, yeah, before you had this attitude that if there's a tree growing, you know, in front of your house and it'll block your view of the beach or something, you just go and chop the bloody thing down.
Mm.
People's perceptions of what's important and what's not important have changed. And so you find that there's not so much of that sort of thing going on now. People are much more aware of the importance and the value that plants have in our environment. I think that there's definitely a trend towards, you know, growing your own, particularly, you know, veggies, growing your own veggies, or having a go at growing your own veggies and your own fruits. Because people are just, you know, starting to realise how everything's connected, you know, like there's so much emphasis now on maintaining bee populations. And so a lot of design work is actually around plants that will attract bees into that environment. And even, you know, people are getting into beekeeping.
Yeah. Just
realise that what an important element the bee occupies in our existence, you know.
Well, how important are pollinators?
If you don't have pollinators, you don't have plants. That's basically what it all boils down to. Some plants rely on external species to pollinate them, and whether that's an animal brushing up against one plant and then brushing up against another one, or whether it's, you know, bees, you know, crawling around inside and picking all the pollen up. Lots of plants have different ways of pollinating. Like some can self-pollinate, but a lot of them can't. And if they can't pollinate, then they cark it. That's basically what happens. And if they cark it, we cark it.
My gosh. Because I think people have been so quick to eradicate the pests. Like, you know, everyone uses, like, pesticides on their home gardens. Yeah.
It's so convenient to do that. But, you know, there are other ways. And like lots of older gardeners will have a whole range of backyard cures and remedies to get rid of different, you know, bugs without having to use some bloody toxic chemical that can, you know, wipe out all the decent species as well as the bad ones, or can get into the, you know, the creeks and the waterways and kill the fish and the frogs. You know, it's so much more to it. And the average person, like once they buy something from a shop, a chemical, and they use it, and as far as they're concerned, that's the end of the story. Like nothing else that happens after that. But they don't realise the the impact of what that chemical has on all sorts of other species long after they've sprayed all over their plants.
You know? Yeah, there should be more sort of regulation, or it seems like it's just profits take precedent on everything. So, you know, they know, the people selling them know the risks, but it's okay. There's no regulation. It's okay for them to just sell it to, you know, Joe Blow down the road. They use it and then it gets dumped in the waterways. Like, it just, it seems so backwards.
Yeah, it just needs to be a real move afoot to educate people a whole lot more on what the negative impact is on a lot of the stuff that they actually buy. And it's just like this throwaway economy. You just buy it, spray it, and then throw the container in the bin, forget about it, without even considering what's going to happen from that point on.
Yeah.
To the insects and, you know, and the plants that are going to be impacted.
Well, I don't know. I've heard about a new podcast that's currently coming out, so maybe people will learn through listening to me. So you were talking about older gardeners and just little tips and tricks on how to get rid of pests. So I've heard that if you plant peppermint, it naturally is a deterrent for certain bugs to come into the garden. Is that right?
Yeah, there's books written on a whole range of different plants that have benefits like that, you know, like marigolds, for example. You put marigolds in your garden, they tend to have an effect on mosquitoes, and mosquitoes won't be as prevalent in your garden as what they would without the marigolds. They're called companion plants.
Yeah.
I don't know whether one of the books you stole from my bookshelf was the one on companion planting, but
it definitely was. I think that's where I got the peppermint story.
Oh, there you go.
You'd think that everyone would have marigold in their backyard living in Australia. Like, the mozzies are wild.
Yeah, but see, they have no concept.
No idea.
No concept at all of, you know, how companion plants work. Because there's a whole bunch of different like relationships with plants. Like some plants, they work in cooperation, I suppose, would be the best way to put it, with other plants. And then, you know, there's little organisms that hang around the roots of some native plants, and they help the plant to actually tap into the supply of, say, nitrogen or potassium, you know, any of the three major elements that the plants need. And these little, this relationship between an insect and a plant is mutually beneficial.
You know, yeah, wow. Plant,
yeah, it's very interesting. You won't learn about it just by Googling.
You've got
one of those books that explains it in detail.
And like the one you've got. Yeah. I've actually read that book cover to cover. I found that really interesting, and it helped me when I did my little herb garden, and I knew like what not to plant next to another one. Like, I know that tomato and basil obviously go good together, but there's other ones. Some of them don't work well with rosemary. So if you have rosemary in your garden, other plants won't grow. It's interesting. So you've spoken a couple of times about natives. So what are some Australian natives that people could put in their garden to sort of attract more pollinators?
Oh, grevilleas. Grevilleas, number one.
Are they pink flower, the pinky red flower?
There's hundreds of different varieties.
Yeah.
Pink, yellow, red, white, lemon. There's millions of Banksias, another one that is really prolific with bees and other insects. But they're like those two, the two standouts, particularly grevilleas.
Yeah. Okay.
Like, not only the bees, but their little honey eaters, little honey eaters, you know, little birds with their wings flap so fast you can't even see them.
Oh, hummingbirds?
They just hover over the flower and take the nectar and off they go.
Oh, cute. And what the wattle birds, don't they?
They disperse the seed from the wattles.
And so what are the kind of care instructions that you have for preserving natives in the garden or in the wild?
It depends what, you know, varieties. Like they've adapted to their environment, and a lot of them actually require, you know, fire, like bushfires, to come through an area, burn the seed casings, and that actually triggers the germination of those seedlings or those seeds.
Yeah, you told me that when we just had the black summer bushfires, and I was heaps distraught, and you were like, don't worry, they're actually going to regrow, like they need this.
Yeah, well, you can see it after a fire's gone through. There'll be all new regrowth, because what happens when the Banksia cones become, you know, burnt in the fire, that sets off the germination process. The cones open up and they disperse the seeds, and then the seeds just regenerate and off you go again. A lot of the other plants, Australian native plants, have got other modifications where they've got little buds, they call them epicormic buds, that are just below the surface of the bark. And when the tree gets, you know, frazzled in a bushfire, it burns off the bark on the outside, but it actually stimulates these epicormic buds, these little buds that are hidden, and they reshoot, and that's where you see all the new growth on, you know, the old burnt black gum trees. And
oh, so they fly out kind of up into the air, sort of.
No, that's just a bud. Like a bud for a normal plant, but it's hidden below the bark.
Right. And
so when the tree's frazzled in a bushfire, that actually stimulates these buds to come into action, and they'll actually shoot out through the bark. Don't you see like a little tiny green growth coming out through the bark? And next thing you know, you've got little branches, little green branches everywhere.
That's amazing when you think about it. That is so. If you could do one thing forever in terms of horticulture, what would you like to do, or what would you like to see more people doing?
Probably thinking about sustainability.
Mm.
You know, growing your own produce. Which includes animals, you know, like chooks and ducks and things, you know, like ducks, for example. If you've got a couple of ducks and you let them loose in your garden, they'll eat all your snails, you know.
Oh.
And there's so many simple solutions that people just aren't aware of, you know.
And so focusing more on the interconnectedness.
Yeah. So instead of going out and buying snail and slug killer and putting that all around your garden and having the chance that your pets will eat it or consume it and die, buddy, a couple of ducks, you can get eggs from ducks as well. They're much bigger than chooks' eggs, and the ducks are real funny animals as well. I could sit there, because we had a duck when we were kids, and you'd sit there and watch him all day. It's like a vacuum cleaner. Goes around, picks up all the old fruit and stuff from under the trees, and they're just if people spend a little bit more time with some of those animals, they'd realise the benefit to producing their own food and better tasting food as well.
Yeah. So, Dad, I think you would agree, you'd say that horticulture is quite a rewarding career. Would you recommend it to people who are thinking about more green career pathway in the future?
Oh, certainly. There's so many aspects to horticulture, and I'm sure that if people sort of delved into it, I'm sure that they'd find at least one aspect that would be really interesting to them that they'd never even thought about before. That's the only way we're going to move on.
For sure. And if people are wanting to, like, they might not want to go and study or anything at this point, but they do want to learn more about plants. So if you were going out into just for a hike or something and you wanted to study the plant life around you, what are some of the things that you should try to learn in to be able to identify species?
If you go for a walk out in the national parks, you can see how the vegetation changes from one area to another. You might like down here, up around the escarpment, it might change from woodland to heathland over the space of 200 metres or 100, even 100 metres. And that's because the soil changes, the microclimate of that particular area changes, and only plants that are sort of adaptable to that microclimate and that type of soil, because it may have different nutrients available, the water levels may be different. First thing you'll notice is if there's a change in the type of vegetation from what you've been looking at to what you're looking at now, it's usually because of a change in soil type and microclimate.
Wow, that's so interesting. And so will that affect the display of the leaf shape and the colouring of the flower and everything as well?
You can manipulate, in some plants you can manipulate flower colour, like hydrangeas, for example. You can change from pink flowers to blue flowers just by altering the pH of the soil that they're planted in.
No way.
So, you know, you might add more organic matter to the soil to increase the pH, for example, and that'll change the colour of the hydrangea flower. There's other plants you can do the same thing with.
So could you grow, like, say, pink and blue right next to each other, but you just altered, like, a portion of the soil and it'll turn a different colour?
Yeah.
Whoa, that's mind-blowing.
Go for a walk through the bush. It's, if you're with somebody who knows what they're talking about, it's just really, really interesting.
Well, Dad, as soon as I can come back to New South Wales, I'm going to be taking you out for some bushwalks. you can draw because I'm terrible, but you can draw the leaf shapes and everything for my journal. Well, thanks, Dad. Thanks for joining us on the pod for our first industry deep dive. Did you have fun?
Yeah, it was good. Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Do it again.
Thanks for joining us for our first industry deep dive. Join us next week as I go through our plant profile series, documenting the history, therapeutic uses, and benefits of common herbs and essential oils. You can also join us via our Facebook group or follow us on Instagram for more botanical content. See you next week.